Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Venezuela is once again at a crossroads, now with the death of their charismatic leader Hugo Chavez, who changed the direction of the country. What does the legacy of Chavez mean for Venezuela's present and future? Three experts join us. Daniel Levine is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Michigan and the author of The Quality of Democracy in Latin America and Constructing Culture and Power in Latin America. Jennifer McCoy also joins us. She is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Carter Center's Americas Program at Georgia State University. She is the author of International Mediation in Venezuela and editor and contributor to The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. David Smildy is also with us. He is professor of sociology at the University of Georgia and co-editor of Participation, Politics, and Culture in Venezuelans' Bolivarian Democracy and co-author of Reason to Believe, Cultural Agency in Latin American Evangelicalism. Thank you for being with us. I want to start with a historic context that gives us an idea for today's Venezuela, which seems very polarized. David Smildy, as you've studied the movements that have brought us to the current situation, what historic context do you think we need to know to understand this?
Well, I think to understand the current context, and especially polarization, I think you need to understand the 15 years before Chavez, in which from 1983 through 1997, there was a really dramatic increase in social polarization. Poverty doubled, inequality doubled. There was a real deterioration in the lives of a lot of average Venezuelans. Chavez is elected in 1998 at the end of a cycle of real deterioration of Venezuela's electoral democracy, especially in terms of the political parties. And in 1998, he's elected, comes on with a program or a platform of participatory democracy, and pushes through a new constitution, and during these first couple of years has a really very high level of popularity. At the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, things really start to deteriorate in the sense that Chavez then starts to move towards trying to push social and economic democracy and really try to change the economy. And that's when the real polarization begins. Since then, in Venezuela, both sides have not wanted to recognize the other side and their legitimacy. And so both sides really see themselves as fighting for their lives. And that leads to a real process of polarization. Now, Chavez, of course, as everybody knows, passed away almost 2 weeks ago now. And that puts Nicolas Maduro in position to become the next president. It looks like he will be elected. He currently has about a 15-point advantage in the polls. But this polarization process still continues, even in the perception of what Chavez's death means.
Jennifer McCoy, what else do you think we need to understand?
I think that what we see in Venezuela, we've also seen in some other Latin American countries. In cases where there is deep inequality, especially income inequality, but also it can be gaps and discrimination against groups of people, such as indigenous people. When you combine the level of grievances of people who have felt ignored or excluded for a long time with the right to vote, then we see a real demand for change. And in countries where the institutions aren't strong enough, if the political parties and the governments aren't strong enough to manage that change, then you can go in unpredictable directions. So in the Venezuelan case, the political parties who had been very strong in the 1970s and 80s became discredited in the 1990s as people were sliding into poverty, oil prices were down. And so people voted for change and for radical change without a clear knowledge or guide of where Hugo Chavez, whom they voted for in 1998, would go.
Daniel Levine.
Two things. First, it's certainly true that the situation is very polarized. One thing to note is that the whole political system that Chavez replaced was one which tried to mute polarization. And then after a while, it became impossible to mute the polarization because of the elements that David indicated. The second thing I would add is that the Chavez, as a movement and in power, has deliberately accentuated polarization in his rhetoric, in his public mobilizations. It's been a government which has thrived on mobilization, mass mobilization, and polarization. So in terms of purely political polarization, I think it's increased. I also think it's likely to increase in the future But purely political polarization has definitely been a strategy of this regime and government, and will probably continue to be one in the future if Maduro wins, as David says. So it's likely, and I imagine it is likely.
It strikes me that there's a very black and white thinking that has emerged with Hugo Chavez, sort of a good guys versus bad guys, that has really resonated with people. Would you say that was part of the construction of power?
For Chavez, absolutely. I think the way to understand Chavez is he is the product, partly the product of the decay of the previous system. He didn't cause the decay of the previous system. The previous system had many problems, as everyone knows, and as David and Jennifer have pointed out. But he's sort of the product of that and of the discredit of that. His whole original campaign was, I am not them. And he called for a refounding of the republic and a political strategy which has been imitated in other countries, calling for a new constitution, for redefining the basis of the nation. And he has been very active in an us-them kind of rhetoric. He was active throughout his career, and that has continued with Maduro, who has used many of the same phrases and rhetoric that Chavez himself used.
This is Jennifer McCoy. I think also when we see in a country really deep grievances that people can and often do vote for a strong leader. And we've seen this, for example, with security fears in Colombia voting for Uribe when he wanted to take a strong hand, or in Bolivia when the indigenous voted for an indigenous leader. In Venezuela, Chavez was a dominant figure unlike Venezuela had seen in decades. And he definitely had the personality, had the charisma, the communication skills, and the ambitions to assert really phenomenal power of generating, you know, a love-hate relationship with many people. So as Dan said, there was an incredible devotion of many people who felt like they were receiving for the first time the respect of a leader who also gave them voice and represented them and emphasized how he was like them, came from humble roots like them. And then there were those who felt excluded from his vision and from his government, who have been, you know, very strongly opposed to him and who felt like that they were losing their own lifestyle. And that's why the debate has been, as David said, almost an existential debate over people who felt like there were two directions for the country to go, and either one side would lose the essence of their lifestyle.
David Smiley, let's bring you back in on this. You've been following the civil society there and creating a democratic system of sorts that have been different from the historic democracy in Venezuela. How would you describe what it's become?
It's actually been a number of different phases throughout the Chavez government. As I mentioned before, Chavez came to power, and the real key metaphor for Chavez was participatory democracy. And this was the idea that if we could just get in all these civil society groups and social movements involved, that that would deepen democracy and that would create a more sensitive democracy, one that functions better and meets citizens' needs. Of course, the problem is when you actually try to have a governing project and you have this cacophony of voices, it can be very difficult to actually get anything done. By 2002 or so, Chavez clearly was moving to a much more centralizing logic to his governing project. And traditional civil society, you know, was largely excluded. In fact, in the period of 2002-2004, the opposition to the Chavez government often referred to itself as la sociedad civil. It was civil society. When there was a coup in 2002, coup that took Chavez out of power for 48 hours, at that moment it became really clear to the government that a lot, you know, the pro-government civil society groups, or community radio stations, pro-government social movements were very, very important to their survival. And so after that period, for a number of years, they really started supporting and founding all kinds of social movements and pro-government civil society groups. By 2006, that became a, you know, much more robust effort to try and really create and control these citizen participation through groups like communal councils, cooperatives, and now more recently communes. And so now we have this much more corporatist project in which the government has this idea, you know, the next sort of stage would be the communal state, has this idea that there will be articulation from the citizen all the way up to the executive branch through these different levels of participatory initiatives. So it's become something quite different than what it originally started as.
Jennifer McCoy, I believe you called it a hybrid democracy, sort of democratic, but had these authoritarian qualities. How would you describe this?
It's a big debate over how to characterize the democracy among a lot of observers, journalists, as well as scholars. Certainly, the electoral basis of the regime is clearly democratic. The new kinds of participatory mechanisms are a way to deepen the democracy and create more avenues of participation, what David was just describing. On the other hand, the sort of traditional liberal democracy approach that many people in the United States favor includes a strong emphasis on the separation of powers, independent branches of government. And that's what has become blurred in Venezuela, with the strength of the governing party basically controlling most of the branches of government and the democratic institutions. So many in the opposition in Venezuela feel like that they are not independent of political influence from the government, let's say the courts, the judicial system. There are questions about that. So that's where the debate lies, really, I'd say, on that liberal democracy vision versus the more participatory democracy vision that the Chavez movement has been trying to implement.
Daniel Levine, you try to separate the idea of democracy from good governance or good results. How would you characterize Venezuela's quality of democracy?
Jose Molina and I published a paper recently in which we called it a democracy of low quality, but still a democracy. We were roasted in the place where we participated. People said, well, how much do you have to remove from democracy for one still to be able to call it a democracy? I'd just like to comment on some of the points that David and Jennifer made. First of all, this is the most centralized government and the most highly personalized government in easily 80 years or so. Chavez concentrated more power in himself than any president since Juan Vicente Gomez, and that's a lot. Secondly, as to the courts and the question of whether or not there's independence in the branches of government, the brute fact is that there is no independence in the courts. It's just a joke, really, to talk about it. There are elections, that's certainly true. There are significant questions about accountability of government officials and transparency, that basically is very little. And I wanted to comment briefly on the question of this so-called alternative project for participatory democracy. There's a lot of doubt about the actual independence of these groups and the extent to which they are civil society groups functioning from below, or whether they are mechanisms of control and transmission from above. The research that I've seen, and I've recently been reading a lot of stuff by Venezuelan scholars on this, indicates that, first of all, participation in many communal councils is very spotty, is highly tied to membership in or getting benefits from the government or the official party. And they're just not independent groups as we conceive of civil society. So if you're talking about it as an alternative form of participation, I think it's important to factor in that it's a form of participation which is highly structured and shaped from above. So there are significant problems of accountability, I think, and there are some questions about the relative autonomy of these civil society groups, particularly the communal councils and the other groups that they replaced in the future. Chavismo in its career has gone through lots of organizational vehicles. Communal councils are now what they're talking about. We'll see in the future whether they continue to restlessly create more vehicles or whether these acquire some life of their own. I have my own doubts about it.
David Smalley.
I think that, you know, that's exactly right. And I think you could actually go beyond that and say it's not that there's a real question about the autonomy of these groups. The government has a very explicit project that these groups should not be autonomous, that they should be part of this whole project that extends from the presidency all the way down through several levels, all the way to these projects. They're seen as something that should be part of this national project. They should be articulated with the national vision. Of course, it's an ideology that's very much a corporatist type ideology that goes back to, I think, a very different political culture, one that thinks of, you know, it's a more Republican type political culture in which we have to be the nation and, you know, morality comes from the collectivity and everything has to be part of one organism, this general will. And so I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's not much autonomy, and I think that the aim of the communal state is to erect a whole new geometry that really gets rid of the whole idea of autonomy because they don't really believe in it.
Jennifer McCoy, one other aspect of your research, which deals with the issue of corruption, you seem to have argued that addressing that is the core issue has been part of the problem. What is the situation?
In Venezuela, in part because of oil wealth, there has been always an issue with corruption, particularly as oil prices get high. And there's a lot of money to go around, and a lot of people benefit in positive ways and legal ways, but there's also a lot of opportunity for corruption. Venezuela has had in the past problems of corruption with exchange rate controls back in the 1980s, and similarly today. It's very hard to measure, to know what the levels are now versus the past, but I would just say it's a persistent problem in Venezuela. And the way to address it is to have accountability mechanisms, which gets back to one of Dan's points. You need transparency and accountability mechanisms. And there you do need to have oversight mechanisms, institutions that are independent sufficiently to be able to investigate and to hold, you know, to account the various branches of government, anybody that's controlling public funds, and transparency about budgets, about public spending, so that citizens can also hold their elected representatives and appointed officials accountable. It's been difficult to get some of that information to be able to really assess, and for citizens to be able to, and journalists as well, I'd say media, to be able to investigate enough to know whether or not or how to hold their own government accountable. And then you also get to the question that Dan was discussing before about the courts and the other accountability mechanisms.
Let's turn now to the current state and what we see in the future. David Smiley, you started by talking about where the polls are pointing, suggesting that Chavez's successor is going to win in the upcoming election. Who are the candidates? What do we need to know about them? And what are going to be the issues that ultimately decide the election?
The candidate that was designated by Chavez is Nicolas Maduro, who was Chavez's foreign minister for the last 6 years. And Chavez in December made a very dramatic announcement that he was returning to Cuba for surgery, and that if anything were to happen, that he wanted Nicolas Maduro to be his political successor, and he asked people to vote for him. Maduro himself is a person without Chavez's charisma. He comes from the left side of the spectrum within the Chavez government. He's a union negotiator, so he has a sort of pragmatic side. However, the core of his political ideology is anti-imperialism. He was foreign minister, so most of his rhetoric has to do with Venezuela in this world that's dominated by the United States and independence and autonomy and the nation, etc. His basic campaign has been to point to Chavez and mention Chavez's name as many times as possible, because basically his strongest attribute in these elections is that he was designated by Chavez and has Chavez's blessing, and so that's why people will be supporting him. The opposition candidate is Enrique Capriles Radonsky. He was the opposition candidate in the October 2012 elections. Last year, he ran as a sort of can-do reconciler, almost as sort of an uncandidate, to try and show a different side or something different from Chavez, who was always politicizing everything and strongly ideological. That got him to 45%, which was the best showing of any candidate running against Chavez. And so that was a pretty good feat. This election in 4 weeks, and he's taken a very different path. I think it makes sense, a much more aggressive path. He's basically trying to separate the image of Maduro and Chavez and come out much more frontally against Maduro. Now, as far as issues, so far the campaign has been largely issue-free. Maduro doesn't address issues because basically his strongest card is the fact that Chavez designated him. Capriles isn't addressing issues. He's just taking Maduro on very frontally. I personally think that's a big mistake. I don't think he's going to win the election, but I think this would be a good moment for the opposition to really show what ideas they have for the problems that are affecting Venezuela and what ideas they have for the future of Venezuela. And who knows, that could maybe give him a boost in the polls, as Bill Clinton did in 1992 or Chavez himself in 1998 really came on and had really substantive messages about the issues, messages that people could understand. so far, the campaign has shaped up to be largely issue-free.
Now, Maduro has just recently also severed communication with the U.S., which seems like part of his statement, this anti-imperialist statement that he's making to his constituency, again, kind of feeding that good guys and bad guys framework. I assume that will go over well, but what does that say for the future of Venezuela in international relations? Jennifer McCoy?
They haven't severed all relations. The embassies are still open. We haven't had ambassadors in either country for a couple of years, but there's still contact through the rest of the staff at the embassies. What they said was they would suspend the recent contacts and conversations that had begun last fall, October elections, about having improved ties and beginning to discuss a new exchange of ambassadors. So they're putting that off for now. I expect that it could be renewed after the elections. As I think David said, the anti-imperialism message has always been a strong campaign message of Chavez and now of Maduro as well. It's also been part of the foreign policy goals of Chavez since he was elected to sort of change the balance of power in the world and create more of a multipolar balance of power rather than a unipolar world with the U.S. dominating both in this hemisphere and globally. And so that's been one of his ambitions for the last 14 years as well, is sort of a serious foreign policy vision. And then put on top of that campaign rhetoric, it's always good to rally around the flag and, you know, carry out a nationalist message is often, seen as politically favorable.
This is Daniel Levine. I'm not an economist, but as I've just been reading some economics papers, as I understand it, but the United States is still the single largest trading partner, although the balance is changing. One of their policies has been to get rid of investments that the National Oil Company had overseas. They're trying to shift the balance of their trade, but their trade with the United States is still quite important. I think that a break in relations, as both David and Jennifer said, is not, they both affirm that that is not really in the cards. I think this is more an electoral issue right now.
So it's really just rhetoric is what you're saying.
Well, it's always been a lot of rhetoric, but it's certainly true what Jennifer said, that Chavez from the beginning did want to reshape Venezuela's position in international affairs, and in imitation of his hero, Bolivar. He was looking for a unification of Latin Americans in contrast to North Americans. But nonetheless, there is still an important relation with the United States, a cultural relation, an economic relation that does remain, although political relations are not very good. That's certainly true.
And so how do you see it shaping up now in the post-Chavez Venezuela in terms of the balance of power as Venezuela moves on to its next leader? He did do a lot to try to unite Latin America, and he also allied quite a bit with those that the United States would deem not such great friends, Iran and, you know, certainly Gaddafi when he was there.
Well, I can say something quickly about that. I think that if Maduro wins, seems likely, I think these policies will remain in force, although I think it's going to be much more difficult for Maduro to manage all the elements of that coalition. The Chavista coalition is heterogeneous. He doesn't have that personal force that was held together by Chavez, not by anybody else. And I think it'll be difficult. I think there are various possible scenarios for the future. One is a continuation of the current situation, which is a slow tightening of controls, attacks on independent elements in civil society, attempts to gather more, as David said, a more corporatist control model. Another one is more open participation by the military, who are the big institutional gainers of the last 20 years. The military has grown a great deal and has a great deal of presence in public administration. A third one, which preoccupies me very greatly, is endemic conflict. I mean, it is a very polarized society, and as everybody here has said, each side distrusts the other, sees the other as an existential threat. And what bothers me and what worries me is the possibility of low-grade to high-grade violence over the future between these sides. That has never been a feature of Venezuelan political history in the modern period. But it could happen. There is precedent in other countries for this, such as the long-term low-grade hostility and violence between Peronistas and the military in Argentina. Anything's possible. I think the country has immense problems. Its infrastructure is falling apart. Inflation is high. imports are very high, the currency is not in very good shape, they produce less petroleum, import more than they used to, violence is a problem, insecurity, there's a lot of problems, really concrete problems that any government will have to address within the country, and whether or not it will be able to do so before it goes out to pursue an aggressive foreign policy isn't very clear to me. I just don't know that they will have the ability to, he'll have the ability, whoever it is, to hold that coalition together effectively.
I wanted to get a sense of what the current mood on the ground points to. David Smiley, how you see the direction pointing from there in Caracas?
I could say just quickly that since Chavez died, that has been the overwhelming news. And the polls have shown that Maduro got a big boost from Chavez's passing and Chavez's own memory. And so that's been the overwhelming news. Chavez's positive numbers are about 68%. The negatives are less than 20%. So that's, I think, the overwhelming sense right now. There doesn't seem to be a lot of jubilation or, you know, real ferment in the streets. It seems to be kind of quiet these days, and you know, everything points to a continuation of the Chavez project under the direction of Nicolas Maduro.
Well, we will see how that goes in a couple of weeks with the election as the starting point of the next era. Jennifer McCoy, Daniel Levine, David Smiley, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Levine is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Michigan and the author of The Quality of Democracy in Latin America. Jennifer McCoy is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Carter Center's Americas Program at Georgia State University. She is the author of International Mediation in Venezuela. David Smiley is a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia and co-editor of Participation, Politics, and Culture in Venezuelans Bolivarian Democracy. That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at Armudian. We'll see you next week.